and tubes. I'm having trouble believing that DC voltage is fed to it, only one polarity. And if it is flipping in polarity, in order not to have one electrode versus the other electrode age artificially, one being a cathode and one being an anode, then I ask the question, how fast are they flipping? If it's got a built-in inverter and it's flipping at 100 kc, which means it's really flickering at 100 kc, which is so high compared to 60 cycles, I believe under those conditions, Larry would not see any ray. I think it's the guy who asked the question. He's not going to see any stroboscopic effect with the blade on his circular saw. So how does a compact fluorescent tube, are they being fed DC or is it very high frequency AC? And if it's very high frequency AC, the next question, of course, is going to be electromagnetic interference. So give us a few words on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
Well, there's a lot of ways of doing this. There's the inexpensive ways, which is the old way. They used to put the old starter circuit in it, and they used to run them off 60 cycles, and then they made some other rectification circuits with triacs, and they did a whole bunch of other things, all of which over time have the capability of making some very, very noisy lighting. So those are probably the worst, especially for flicker and those kinds of problems. When you get into the better fixtures, the more professional fixtures, you'll find out that the companies who produce the ballasters aren't resistors and windings anymore. They're real power supplies, and they put out high-frequency, chopped, square waves into the fluorescent tubing. So it's very, very high-frequency energy. And if the frequencies are set properly, the correct filtering is inside the driver, they still call them ballasters, but they're really high-frequency drivers these days, and they have all the correct filtering and everything, they're as quiet as an incandescent. So a lot of that really depends on how much money you're willing to spend on your lighting. So you can get the high efficiency, you can get the low noise, you can get the low flicker, but generally those like really good GE and Sylvania high-end fixtures, they start at about $250 an uptick.
And as you said earlier, you get what you pay for when it comes to light-emitting diode, relatively high cost, but high performance of lighting, light-emitting diode lighting. In the compact fluorescent bulbs that I buy in Home Depot, let me drop for a second. Oh boy, this cold. Good thing you didn't hear that coughing. The base of the bulb has got the power supply. I'm going to guess that it's some kind of a high voltage, high frequency inverter, like maybe 100 kc. I'm guessing that what the real spirally looking compact fluorescent thing is being fed is a high frequency alternating current. It's going through zero. However, if the frequency is high enough, therefore you've got a certain amount of ionization time of the mercury vapor inside, and a certain dwell time of the phosphor. I see the possibility of real 100 kc chopped inverted frequency or even a megacycle going to the compact fluorescent bulb, but the bulb itself can't extinguish itself that fast, and therefore the true light output, not only is it high in frequency like 100 kc, but very little distinguishing because of the whole time of the mercury vapor ionization as well as the whole time of the phosphor itself. So therefore, if I tried to do my high frequency stroboscopic effect measurement on my compact fluorescent tubes, what am I likely to find? I'm a little bit afraid that if I try to go to the data sheet of that thing that I buy in Home Depot, they're not going to tell me those details. What if you got any guesses on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, I'm glad you're here tonight. KQRIW in the TechNet.
They're all over the place, Dick. There's really no standard on it. What you'll find is that some of the compact fluorescents are nothing more than a very, very simple starter circuit, a resistor, and a rectifier. And they don't last very long. Then you have other ones that have basically the starter circuit inside of it, a line switching circuit, and the majority of the ones that I saw out there that are probably relatively inexpensive, like, around the $3-$4 per CFL bulb at about 13 watts or so, those are kind of like a hybrid. They have like a 5 kilohertz switching circuit that's attached to the full sine wave line, And those tend to be some of the better ones for uses in lamps. And they tend to last, you know, well over, you know, 20,000 hours. And, as long as they're used in lamps. And very quiet, no EMI, very excellent power factor, and pretty good in efficiency. To really get the high frequency fluorescent tubes, at that point you're into real professional fixtures. In other words, now you have to have a baluster inside there that's wired to a fixture, and generally those fixtures have very specialized connections and how they're wired so that you have a very nice way of handling the high frequency, and they're shielded so that you don't get the high frequency EMI out of them. So that's what I'm saying. That's why they tend to get a lot more expensive when you get into these. But there, I've seen the fluorescent tube fixtures that are like in the $250 category and up. They'll last, you know, close to 50,000 hours, Vic. They're, you know, at least well over 25,000 in those fixtures without having to replace a bulb.
Very nice. One of the experiments I want to put on my list of things I'm doing with putting chocolate in microwave ovens and putting salt water into cans and putting my hands inside and measuring resistivity. I'm tempted to get an interrupter blade, something on a spinning motor where I can change the speed of the motor, and therefore I'll be able to look at the stroboscopic effect out of a compact fluorescent tube of various brands. Do you think I'll be able to see any stroboscopic effect at all, Glenn, or do you think that the whole time of the phosphor and the mercury vapor is such that there's almost nothing there to observe? What's your guess on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
Even the cheapest fixtures today, Dick, the amount of flicker that you're going to see in fluorescent lights, I would say probably the real reason that you're seeing flicker in a fluorescent tube is probably because the fixture's old. Because some of the older fixtures weren't designed all that well, and they've really improved over the years. And I would say if you probably have, a fairly decent, fixture that's maybe since, say, 2000 or later, you know, something less than 10 years old, you're probably not going to see much of any flicker at all. I think that you'd have to have some real off-brand, you know, cheap and dirty type of thing before you'd start to see flicker in fluorescent tubes.
Okay, you've tempted me. I've got some old ones. I've got some new ones. If I've got the time, I'm going to do that experiment because I'm discovering an awful lot of things are different than expected. Okay, anybody with any further questions or comments on the subject of light-emitting diodes, compact fluorescent tubes, and similar fixtures? By the way, if Eric was here, he would be telling us of the new light-emitting diodes they put on the Empire State Building, where they can very rapidly change color and draw patterns and do all kinds of fancy things. The only slight problem they ran into is the light-emitting diodes are so efficient, they put out almost no heat, that when snow falls on them, until they've solved that problem, the snow can blink the bulbs on them. But hey, with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KD2ALC comment.
Go right ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, Dick and Glenn. I've been using LEDs and fluorescents for quite a while. I probably have about 85% of the house covered with fluorescent or LED and all different types. One of the big disadvantages with a CFL is that if you have cooler temperatures, like in your basement, they take a while to warm up unless you get an instant start, but most of them are not. LEDs come on right away. As far as using them in lamps, if you get a quality one like the ones that LIPA is selling, the Philips 60-watt equivalent, I believe they're 2,700 or 3,200 Kelvin, they work wonderfully in a lamp. So, actually, I don't understand that part of it. Why buy the fixture if you don't need it, if you have a lamp that you like? Let me drop it. The other thing I can say is that there's so many different variations now that you can get. As far as the downlights, they actually fit into the existing cans, and they work beautifully, and they seal it. So actually, at the same time that you're putting the light in, you're also sealing it from any of the hot air going up through your ceiling. They work wonderfully. I've done the whole upstairs with those. I've used fluorescent MR16 lights in halogen fixtures. There's lots of things out there, and if you buy one at a time, you can find out what works for you. Over.
Is that your set, Dick? Go ahead, Glenn.
Very good points that you're making, but there's a couple things you have to understand when you're talking about LEDs. Cree makes a overhead hi-hat replacement, and I think it's a pretty quality circuit from what I've seen. I own them myself, but there's a couple of warnings that I'm going to tell people about. If people have older wiring in their house and they've used hi-hats with incandescent light bulbs and they've tried fluorescent and now they're trying to switch over to to an LED, they may be finding a multitude of problems here. One of the problems that you run into is that the circuits that run the LEDs, because they are dimmable, those overhead lights from the Cree versions, and you need neutral ground and power connection. So you need neutral, line neutral and ground throughout to all fixtures, which many of the old wiring was not the way it was done. There was many of the old wiring basically was just, you know, the neutral was kind of daisy chained, and basically you daisy chained the line to a switch. And if you're going to try to attempt to wire your LEDs like that, you're going to have flicker problem with your LED, and they will fail prematurely, those Cree overhead fixtures. So here again, one of the reasons I'm not telling people is just to take out their old incandescent light bulbs and start plugging in the Crees directly is first to make sure the wiring of the fixtures. Because you could be spending a lot of money and have a lot of premature failure and or flicker that you don't want with LEDs. So although it is a good fixture and it's a good replacement, wiring is very important. Now, let me put this drop for a second. I'll talk about the LEDs used in lamps. The best part about a lamp is that it's diffused by its lampshade. Now, some lamps, depending on how the shade arrangement is, you can find certain bulbs will work better than others. And the big problem with using even the LIPA, quote-unquote, Philips bulb, and Philips is a fairly good manufacturer of LEDs, don't get me wrong, but the difference between the screw-in light bulb and using an LED in a lamp as opposed to a overhead fixture that has the LEDs all aiming in the correct direction with the correct filtering, the efficiency, in other words, what you could get in maybe 10 watts, 8 to 10 watts of dissipation in a lamp, you can do with 6 watts of dissipation, 3 to 6 watts in the ceiling. So, I mean, you can have the dissipation just by putting it in a better fixture. That's really what it amounts to. So it's better efficiency, better everything, and longer life. Some of these things will, if you put these LED fixtures in your ceiling and they're wired properly with the correct fixtures, chances are they could outlast your house. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I'm going back to Dennis in a minute because I got a further question for him. But Glenn, what is it about the Cree lamps where they require 3 wire wiring, real, ground, neutral, and line? And if my wiring of my older house only has 2, since the neutral and line, which is where the real power is coming from, are still there, since the ground and the neutral are usually very close in potential, if I wired those together, daisy chained them in the lamp fixture itself, would I still be getting these failures and flicker that you're talking about? And what's special about that Cree that needs that full 3 wires there, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Okay, now you want to know why. Okay, you got to give me some time here. What happens first, the original incandescent light bulbs were relatively inexpensive, and they would take a real beating. One thing nice about incandescent light bulbs were the time constants were in the seconds. So you could have surges that up into 1 second in period that could run right through the light bulb, and, they take a beating and keep on ticking. When you put CFLs or LEDs in ceilings, you get a surge in microseconds, and it's toast. It'll fail faster than a transistor and a mistuned antenna. I mean, quite literally, is it any kind of line bounce, other things, improper wire lengths that are too long going back to fuse boxes? I've seen it all. As a matter of fact, sometimes if you have wire lengths that are going back to your fuse box that are over 25 feet, they advise putting power conditioners on the power line between your line going all the way back. So you have to be careful with things like that because you will see failures just due to line condition that you never had to worry about with with your regular incandescent light bulbs. So there's a lot of thinking that you have to, when you start changing your light bulbs over, you can blindly experiment and just screw things into lamps and you'll have some pretty good success. But when you start going into lighting fixtures overhead, especially when you're trying to replace things, you'll find that just the mere fact that the response time of CFLs and LEDs are much faster, they can also be damaged much faster as well, Nick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Wow, you gave me a mouthful of that one, Glenn. If the line length going back to the fuse panel, the circuit breaker panel, is sensitive, and beyond 25 feet or something like that, you said I might have to put in a line conditioner, that would suggest that line length being length sensitive becomes a kind of resonance, whereas the real power supply, the switching regulator inside of the lighting fixture, now has a high frequency cyclic current drain type thing, and therefore it sounds like it's making a lot of harmonic energy. And so isn't there a harmonic energy spec that the bulb, that the lighting fixture has to meet? I mean, for me to be line length sensitive, implying that high frequencies are going down that line, as not a pure resistive load, a pure 50 ohm resistive load of the light bulb, not 50 ohm, you know what I mean, a pure resistive load. Something funny is going on here, Glenn, and somehow by way of proper wiring of real ground, neutral, and line, a lot of that surge doesn't happen. I mean, just the fact that I've got a third wired ground doesn't necessarily increase or decrease the surge that I get on the hot versus the neutral. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, the main reason for doing that is because the Cree fixtures that we were talking about before, it's a different issue. That's a dimming issue. In other words, the other gentleman was talking about using his overhead Cree fixtures up in the ceiling. And what will happen is that if you don't have the correct wiring in your fixtures, the dimmer isn't going to work properly. It'll work somewhat, but occasionally in certain positions on the dimmer, it'll start to like oscillate, and you'll see a flicker, a low frequency, like probably like 10 hertz. I think it's kind of typical what people will see in the lighting if the fixtures don't have the correct ground. The other thing, too, is the LED CFL dimmers that you can use in the wall all require neutral sense, meaning that if you're connecting up your dimmer in the wall, you have to have, which is just not a matter of breaking the line like a typical switch, you have to have neutral and ground at the dimmer. So this basically, it's always measuring the same voltage, the same closed and open circuit voltage that the fixture is seeing at the dimmer in order to get the correct dimming function. There was another question there, and I've just been talking now, and I forgot what the other one was, so I had an answer for it, I know. I'm going to pass back to you quick, Dick, to remind you. What didn't I answer you? Oh, the high-frequency noise. No, it's not high-frequency that's causing the problem. Let me let it drop for a second. Where the problem is coming into play is in a standard incandescent light bulb, there's relatively a low impedance, a low shunting impedance, and as the current starts flowing through the light bulb, the impedance kind of stabilizes, still at relatively the low impedance of the light bulb. Incandescent light bulbs and LED fixture type of light bulbs have discontinuity, meaning that if you were to put a variac on a compact fluorescent, a regular fluorescent light bulb, or an LED-loaded light, what you'll find out is that as you increase your variac, you'll see no conductivity and no power draw. And then you'll reach like an undervoltage, somewhere like probably around 80 volts or so, between 75 to about 85 volts, and things will start to turn on and flicker, and then boom, and it'll pop on. Where that is not how an incandescent light bulb works. You hook it up to a variac, and you start coming up 25, 30 volts. The incandescent light bulb will just be very, very dim, and will come on very gracefully. When you have line bounce from switches and other things on your where the light bulbs can vary, what's going to happen is you're going to wind up with the light bulb actually turning itself on and off in under voltage conditions. I hope that makes a little bit more sense to you, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, Jason.
Eric recognized? Yes, it does, Glenn, but how does the third wire that I add with proper wiring correct that? Over to you, Glenn, then I'll go over to Eric. Glenn first.
Oh, I thought I explained it. It doesn't. The purpose for the ground, the neutral, and the line connections at the switches for the dimmer, because, in other words, the dimmer, if you don't have all of those connections at the dimmer switch, you don't get the correct line proportional voltage to get proper dimming, the correct dimming function. In other words, it has to sense both neutral and line voltage as the dimming slider goes up and down, because in the old triac type dimmers, basically you could just rotate the dimmer in series, and it could basically just chop the line and dim your light. With the new LED CFLs, you need line sensing and the ground on the fixture. So it's always measuring that your neutral and ground are very, very close to each other. And because it will, in other words, if your neutral starts to shift from ground, the dimmer will correct and hold the light at the correct illumination. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very good information, Glenn. Thank you. Eric, you've done a lot of work with compact fluorescents, dimmers, light-emitting diodes, and so on. Go ahead and add your information. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I'm hearing a lot of stuff I don't necessarily agree with, but I want to ask Glenn two questions. Okay, one question is, I'm not necessarily talking about CFLs, they do a similar thing. Dimmable LED lights, what causes the light to dim? And in a LED-compatible dimmer, how many connections are made to it?
You got it, Glenn.
There are two common ones. There's what I call the poor man's dimming. Poor man's dimming is basically very, very similar to the old triac type of dimming, where you have what they call the three-wire and ground circuit. So basically you have your neutral sense, you have your line and neutral connection. So in other words, you have your line split, so that when the two, in other words, usually it's the red and the black wire in the poor man's dimmer. So basically when you turn that switch on and off, it opens and closes the line. Then you have the neutral sense, which is usually what they call like the red-yellow wire, and that one has to be tied down to neutral, and then the ground gets tied back to your ground all the way back to your circuit box. That's poor man's dimming. Then you have high-end dimming. High-end dimming can be done with typically 0 to 10 volts, and it's low voltage. So this is something that the driver itself has a 0 to 10 volt programmable signal. Now, that signal can be either pulsed, analog, 0 to 10 volts. There are many, many ways that those dimmers can be wired to control the 0 to 10 volt signal and give yourself proportional lighting. And those are actually the best because that way the line can fluctuate anywhere from basically 80 volts to 264 volts, and your lighting remains the same color in lighting and absolutely perfect. And your dimming control is completely independent of line voltage. So as the line voltage swings up and down, transients and everything, the LED driver has hold-up time in it and everything. So that's the premium driver. Poor man's, that's, you know, your typical four-wire connection, Eric. KE2J, KC2QIQ.
All right, well, I'd like to see the dimmers that you're talking about, because I've done a lot of work with LED, dimmable LEDs, and a company called Luon that makes LED-compatible dimmers, okay, whereas all the stuff that I've ever worked with, the driver and the bulb itself looks for pulse, that's in addition to the power line, and the dimmers themselves are basically, get this, a single wire, okay? You hook the hot to one side of the dimmer, you hook the LED to the other side of the dimmer. If you take the dimmer apart, you find there's a resistor there, which they develop a voltage and run a little circuit to create and make the pulses that they put on the output side of the line that the little driver chip inside the LED supply looks at and uses the pulse position of that to determine how much dimming is going to occur. would, that, you know, the line voltage can go up and down, doesn't care. The LED power supply is providing, a constant voltage because it's only running at 3.5 volts or 5 volts, depending upon the type of lighting system that you have. And I just find it interesting that you're telling me, but when I originally thought of, well, before I started with these projects, when I looked at some of the commercial products, I figured that there had to be at least a neutral and a hot, and it turned out I was very wrong about that. And I have taken a scope to this stuff to look and see why there are some variations. And by the way, all CFLs and some of these LED lights produce so much frickin' noise on the line. It's incredible. It's amazing that you can even pick up something RF-wise with all the junk that comes out of it. PQRWP2J.
Actually, can I comment on this one, Dick?
Okay, go right ahead. And when it comes back to Eric, I'm going to tell Eric that, Eric, you sound very good. We're hearing all your words, but you are 20% noise, 80% audio on all of your transmissions tonight. KC2QIQ, KQRIW, go ahead, go in.
Okay, I think what's happened here, Eric, is over the years, these dimming circuits, and I'm pretty sure that the noise that you're talking about is coming from the dimming, not while you're in full conduction. So typically the LEDs that I've seen, here again, bayonet LEDs, and they're the ones that screw into light fixtures, I don't advise anybody really use those. I think personally the CFLs are a cheaper solution that does just as good a job, and the efficiency is probably good enough. I think when you start getting into higher ended fixtures, in other words, when you're remodeling your home, and you're putting in things like the Cree fixtures and other things like that, they're much, much better solutions with real LED drivers in them and everything else. And you can, you know, you're going to be spending a lot of money on your LED lighting, but you can get some very, very premium solutions that'll last long and give you very, very high efficiency in the light. Many of the dimmers that have been available, I think, over, say, like the last 5 or so years, have been changing every couple of years. I've seen them go through different generations. The one that I described last, what I'm calling the poor man's dimmer today, is probably one of the more stable ones, and they create the least amount of noise. I think they're probably, you may be dealing with the technology of some dimmers that are probably a few years old. I think if you go into Home Depot today, the last manufacturer that you had mentioned for dimming produces the four-wire dimmer, and ground, neutral, sense, when the line break, and it's about a $21 or $22 device now, so it may solve some of the problems that you've seen. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
We're getting some good information here. Dennis, KD2AOC, who lives out there, way out there on the North Fork of Cutshork. By far, he's the most eastern guy that we ever talked to on this net on Long Island. Kind of curious as to whether or not you and Jay, since the Peconic Amateur Radio Club is one of the supporters of the Ham Radio University, I wonder if you guys went to the conference today, which is quite a long trip for you guys. Second of all, you normally come in through the Eastern Input, 147.375, which has a local source of interference. Somebody installed a machine that's being corrected and has set some kind of PL tones or whatever are required to get into the machine to stop that noise from coming through. So I wonder how you're coming in tonight, Ray. Here we go. Dennis, KD2ALC, KD2RAW in the TechNet.
Let me say a couple of things there.
What was that, Eric?
Yeah, I converted the machine to a DPL or a DCS, depends on the manufacturer. And by the way, Glenn, I don't have a single incandescent or CFL in my house. Everything is LED. And if you ever want to come over and see it, I'll show it to you.
Okay, you converted it to DPC or DCS. Is that announced over the air as to how to get into the machine, or is that something that they have to talk to Rich, you know what I mean? The president of our club, you have to talk to him to get that information. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, if you're using a GE or a Harris, it's called DPL. If you're using a Kenwood, they call it DCS.
basically what it is digital PL. Got your DCS, DPL, I think Yesu calls it THDC, set it to the value 023, and it'll open the machine for you.
Can you imagine? I couldn't think. Richard's call letters K2KMV. he's gonna be staring at me the next time I see him. Okay. So if a person has that capability, he can get in. And I presume this is a temporary condition for the next week or so until you alleviate that, and then it'll go back to normal. Is that approximately right, Dennis? I mean, boy, I'm great on names tonight. Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Actually, yeah, it's an NMI product. It's always been there. It's part of a trunk radio system, but the guy, or rather the company, 2 weeks ago converted it to digital. And I looked at it on a spectrum analyzer. It really got me annoyed because it's very wide bandwidth. The actual IM product, the NMI product, is about... I say about 4 kc's off the actual frequency, but because of the wide base of the digital signal, I'm being square waved, it just slices through everything. Now, the reason for the change in the PL is because that impulse noise triggers the analog PL. The DSP doesn't understand it. It just says, oh, that's a tone. At least with the digital PL, it has to have the right sequence in order for it to open up, so that's the reason for it.
Sounds good. Dennis, as I said earlier, I wonder if you and Jay, way out there from Cutshog, in his case, can you hear the name of his town, the Peconic Amateur Radio Club, I wonder if you guys made it. And so I'm guessing you're coming in by Echo Link. Is that true, Dennis? KD2AOC, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yes, that's true, Dick. I'm coming in through Echolink off my smartphone. I'm not able to get the digital pulse line, private line. So I've had to come in this way. As far as going to the Ham University, no, I haven't gone. Unfortunately, I was sick and I'm still getting over it. I didn't even go to the talk meeting, which was Friday night. I was actually in the hospital with a virus that attacked my voice box. So, no, I haven't gone. I wish I had. It would have been the first one since I got my license that I would have attended if I had been up to going. Over.
Very fine, Eric. All right, Civico, Dennis, and thank you for coming in from way out there. And, okay, we're all going to get healthier in the future. And we'll be attending all these things. So I had another question for Eric. Oh, my goodness, why can't I think of it right now? Ah. Oh, yes. From time to time, people who I know who are not yet ham radio operators, and they say, gee, I hear about this thing called TechNet. How can I listen to it? To which I say, oh, there's a way you can get a direct feed. If you go to limoc.org, www.limoc.org, and you find the right little section, it'll tell you how. I can't find it. Yeah, you see various things that refer to W2LIE, and when I go to W2LIE, it shows me all kinds of things I can go to with direct feed, but not LIMARC. Is there a magic way that I can go to the LIMARC webpage, Eric, and get a direct feed from LIMARC as to what's going on at that instant of time? So far, I'm not very computer savvy, and I haven't been able to find it. It's not user-friendly from my point of view. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You know, it's been a while since I looked. Why don't you wait a couple minutes and I'll give you a direct answer.
Okay, take your time. I think it's time to go over to the mailbag. We've delayed long enough, John. KC2WGB, you get some damn interesting questions from time to time. What mind blowers have you gotten tonight? Antennas designed while you wait. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Everybody on the net. Yes. Antennas brewed while you wait. Let me just see what I got here. Got a few interesting things. Okay, let me let it drop and I'll pick it up.
antenna. If you can help this young gentleman out, he would like to know why an outdoor antenna, he's talking about a vertical, why do they have a power limit? What difference does it make how much, how many watts you put into it when it's out in the open free air? What is the loss factor? That's his question. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If I was home brewing a very simple 2-meter ground plane, for instance, out of coat hanger wire, and that wire is what? Not quite an eighth inch in diameter, even though it's made out of steel, and it's somewhat resistive. I'm reasonably sure that that simple ground plane antenna would easily tolerate something close to 500 watts key down. Okay, there are kinds of vertical antennas which are made for 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, where they got all kinds of tuning circuits inside, some of them fairly high Q. The word high Q really means there's many definitions of Q. One of the definitions is take the center frequency, divide by the 3 decibel bandwidth of the antenna in the same units, megahertz or kilohertz, divide bandwidth into center frequency, and that's defined as Q. And if my particular antenna had a Q of 10, let's say I'm running at 3.5 megacycles and the antenna is 350 kilohertz wide, I divide one together, I come up with a Q of 10. That tells me something about the bandwidth of the antenna. The Q of 10 is telling you something else. Drop. Whenever I've got an antenna or a tuned circuit running at a Q of 10, somewhere in that circuit, the current that I'm applying is being multiplied by 10. The voltage that I'm applying is being multiplied by 10. So voltage rise at resonance or current rise at resonance and or both are happening as a function of Q. As such, you could get some of these fancier broadband antennas that are running Qs of 10 and 20, relatively narrow band. You tune it to the high end of 40 meters or the low end of 40 meters or the high end of 10 meters. And as such, you think you're putting 100 watts into the antenna. Because it's multiplying the voltage by 10, and since power is a function of voltage squared, that's 100 times higher, you're putting in 100 watts, and it thinks there's 10 kilowatts going through that particular portion of the circuit. So in some cases, you can try it. It takes some loss in the circuit also for that to happen. So I think it's a combination of conservativeness of the manufacturer, because if they tell you it's not rated for more than 250 watts, and if you decide to put 1.5 kilowatts into a key down, you know, a guy shouting into the microphone, so to speak, and you wipe it out, they've got a way of saying that you've exceeded the specification and we're not responsible for it. So some of it I think is conservatism. Some of it could be real. That's what I believe is the mechanism going on here, John. You and I know that under ordinary circumstances, let me drop.
That's the answer to you, Dick.
Okay, is that it sounded like Mike, a little bit noisier than usual, but whoever it was, go ahead with the, we've got the answer for me.
All right, if you go to limeoff.org, and about three quarters of the way down the page, you'll see a box that says monitor, and when you click on it, it takes you to WLA, the W2LIE. When you get to W2LIE, click on scanner feeds, and then scroll down about a third of the way down the page will be W2VL, LIMOS.
Okay. To your knowledge, that is operational 24 hours a day. In other words, the person going there right now could hear what I'm saying. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
That is correct.
Okay. That's the magic information. So I wasn't giving people enough information. They didn't know to go to scanner feeds. I sort of expected that on the LIMOS page, I would find a direct feed to the LIMARC listening capability. So it's a three-step process. Good enough, though. Now I know what to tell people. Okay, so that's my best guess as to what's going on. A little bit of conservatism, a little bit of Q multiplication going on. And in many antennas, if you did exceed that and you burn something up, with rare exception, the components inside that antenna are not very expensive. To replace a disc ceramic capacitor that you burned up or a loading coil, it's not a big deal. So I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep. And in the case of single sideband, if the antenna was rated for 200 watts continuous, and I'm running reasonably normal single sideband speech, and I've got a 1,000 watt transmitter. Yes, your transmitter is hitting peak envelope power of 1,000 watts as you talk, but the crest factor of human speech, almost a 20 decibel difference between the peak power of your speech and the average power of your speech. So if it's single sideband, I think a 200 watt CW rated antenna would probably take a kilowatt of sideband without very much grief, as long as it's not super high clipping speech, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, now just to clear this up a little bit more for him, I'm going to ask you this. Now, the failure mechanism of the antenna, would that be more related to voltage arc over as opposed to current?
If I've got a disc ceramic capacitor built into the antenna somewhere as a tuning element, and if that disc ceramic capacitor at, let me pick a number, 30 megacycles is rated for 20 volts max, and because of my particular use, I'm exceeding that. It's not necessarily arc over. It could be dielectric loss. In other words, the capacitor itself, every capacitor has got an equivalent series resistance. It's got some dielectric loss in its dielectric materials between the plates of the capacitor. And if I'm at a high enough frequency with a high enough amount of power, that disc ceramic capacitor, in my example, is going to run hot. And if it goes to, let me pick a number, 400 degrees centigrade, it's going to turn black and eventually unsolder itself from the PC board and so on. So heating of the element is a little bit more likely than arc over, but arc over can certainly happen. You can overheat a coil, you can overheat a capacitor, you can arc over either one. If it was simply arc over, you and I would go in there with a sheet of Teflon insulation and make sure that the arc over can't take place. So I think it's more than arc over in most cases. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I'm sure that clears that up for this gentleman. Very nice. Okay, now we got a throwback to last week's conversation. The same gentleman with the antenna question and his dB scale on his receiver. He would like to have your description of the easiest way for him to put signals in. He can borrow a good signal generator. He does not have one. And he would like to know, how should he calibrate his S meter so that he can get some dependable readings and resolve that question of whether he's really getting 6 dB or not. That was one interesting response I got.
I've actually done this one, John. In one case, my Heathkit AR3 receiver, way back in the dark ages of the late 50s, I tried to recalibrate, I tried to re-engineer the signal strength meter. In my case, the signal strength meter was a vacuum tube voltmeter plugged into the automatic gain control line, AGC line. I put an extra connector on the back panel of the receiver so I could tap into the 1 megohm impedance AGC line. My vacuum tube voltmeter had a 10 megohm input impedance, so that was quite compatible. And what I eventually did was to bring home a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, and on each of the bands that I cared about, I would crank up the signal generator in 1, 2, 5, 10 dB steps and write down how many volts the vacuum tube voltmeter would read into that receiver. And I made myself a chart. I made myself a graph of microvolts in or dBm in versus volts out of the automatic gain control. By the same token, you can take that signal generator, connect it directly to the receiver, make sure the receiver is on the band that you care about, set in the normal manner, and find out how many dBm or how many microvolts coming out of the signal generator gives you S0, S1, S2, and so on, 20 over 9, 40 over 9. You can make yourself a calibration chart for that particular receiver that you own. And most receivers will hold that calibration rather well. They'll drift a little bit. If it's tube types and the tubes age, it'll drift a little. Solid state, almost nothing. That's probably the best way I could recommend. And now, once you know your response of your receiver, let me drop. 90% of the time, you're going to find out that the definition of the signal strength scale designed by, I'm going to call it ARRL, but I'm not sure. 50 microvolts in the receiver was supposed to be S9. S8 was supposed to be half that voltage, 25 microvolts. S7 was supposed to be 12.5 microvolts, and so on. So that was the absolute calibration and 6 decibels of difference between each S unit. That's the original definition of the signal strength meter. You're going to find out that 90% of the receivers you pick up, there's not 6 dB of difference, there's about 2.5 to 3 dB of difference between the S units. And S9 and 10 over 9 and 20 dB over 9 and so on is not 10 and 20 dB over. You'll find out the scale is very expanded at the low end. It tends to be very compressed at the high end. So it's quite nonlinear. However, once you calibrate it, once you make yourself a graph, a chart for your particular receiver on a known, reasonably good signal generator, the problem essentially goes away. You can learn to live with it once you know what it is. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that gives him a good targeting point. He should be able to calibrate that S meter for every dash on it, actually, and he can know exactly how many microvolts he's receiving. And he'll be able to give meter readings in S units and microvolts. Okay, that should do it for him. Let me go on to the next one, KC2WGB.
Okay, before you do, stand by. After I did that calibration of my yucky old Heathkit AR3 receiver, in modern day flea market, the thing was worth $25 or less, maybe even $10. But I did this elaborate calibration procedure. Had a 432, I was running it at the 40 meter band, so 7 megacycles was my tunable IF on a 432 homebrew converter. And I had calibrated it from the front end of the 432 converter. In those days, the guys on 432 would hear this guy, KQRIW, saying, tonight I'm getting 17.5 microvolts from you. Yesterday I had 15 microvolts. You must have made a change to your receiver, to your antenna, or you aimed it better at me, or some of the leaves falling off the trees. It sounded to those guys so exotic that I had this card file where I would keep track of everybody's signal strength every time I talked to them on the 432 single sideband band, or on the CW band, or whatever, FM band, and lots of guys would, you know, as soon as they raise their antenna to a higher altitude, go to a better antenna, they would say, how many microvolts am I tonight, Dick? And so I was giving out these numbers. I eventually ended up with this card file with 465 guys. In other words, once I put up a really good antenna that consisted of 16 Yagis, you go to the March issue 2008 of CQ Magazine, and there's an article in there by K2RIW called The Magic of Wireless. You go to that article, you'll see a picture of my antenna that I eventually ended up with on the 432 band. Let me drop. And because that antenna gave me 3 times the normal range, which is 10 times more than the normal area, that means there's 10 times as many guys that I talked to on 432, I ended up talking to something like 465 different guys on 432 in 20-some-odd states. I was having so much fun talking to people at long ranges, picking their brains. I had this moon bounce capable antenna on top of 100 feet of tower, this 400 square foot antenna, 3,700 cubic feet of antenna. You'll see a picture of me standing in the middle of it in that article, 2008, CQ Magazine, March issue, which you can go back to the archives and look at it. I never got around to doing moon bounce. The antenna was so much fun, and I was giving out people signal strength and microvolts, and they thought that was very exotic. So once you've got that capability, you'll have a lot more friends, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I'm sure that even if he gets close in those numbers, he should be able to do a good job with it and really be able to look at that antenna as he develops it further on down the line and have a little more substantial results for us, I think. It was good to hear Mike chime in there and that he made another study and came up with it's possible he could be getting 6 dB. I'm sure that's hardened him. Let me let it drop. One more quick one here. Okay, have a young ham who's working on a receiver, and one of the IF cans has a cracked core in it. He was trying to turn it with an Allen wrench, I believe is probably what he did. Broke it. Now, he wants to replace the core. He has several cores of the right diameter, but they're all different lengths, not exact. Is there a way he could cut it down? Would it be all right to file it down? Now, he doesn't even know what the component structure is, but he has a core that will fit, has several. Can he just sand them or file them down? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. Got some quick ones tonight.
Yes, he can. The biggest variable you got to worry about is the core made out of material that has a dielectric constant, is not the right word, mu, is the word I'm looking for, there's another word, permeability. Is the permeability of the core material permeability 10, 20, 50, 100? The chances of the core that was there that he broke, which, by the way, he might be able to take it apart and glue it. That's not out of the question. That would be the simplest. If he can get the pieces out of there and glue them back together, it'll work like a charm. But the new core he's putting in doesn't have similar mu. Now, if the core is being used in such a way that there is a core coming down from the top on the primary winding of the IF can and a core coming in from the bottom on the secondary winding of the IF can, then in that particular case, he doesn't have to cut down the new one. The fact that some of it sticks out above the top or below the bottom is not bad. He can start slowly inserting it and see if he hits resonance. Then he can decide whether or not he wants to cut off some of it so that less of it sticks over. That's one approach. However, in some cases, the core is used in the middle of the IF can, somewhat between the primary and secondary winding. That's the rare one, in which case having the right permeability material and the right length of it could be critical. I think it's unlikely. So you're not going to lose anything to take your core that's too big, but it's got the right threads, and start screwing it in. And the fact that some of it sticks on the outside is not bad. Give it a try. But I would first try to glue it back together, the one that he broke. I probably know what's going to happen, though. When he takes it apart, he's going to have a whole lot of fine little pieces, and if we're really getting it back together, it's going to be very difficult. On top of that, when you're turning one of those, you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you're turning one of those, you really should be using a hexagonal plastic tuning tool to really use a Allen key, which has got the right size. The metal that's in the Allen key is going to do two things. One, it's going to disturb the living daylights out of the tuning while the Allen key is plugged in. And second of all, it is capable of producing tremendous forces that can break the core on you, whereas the plastic tuning tool won't do that. So give it some tries. There's lots of recovery mechanisms here. It's not going to explode. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Have him come back and tell us how well it worked.
Yeah, I'd like to know how he makes out with this. He crumbled this to ashes. I mean, there's nothing left of it. So he can't glue it back together again. But I believe it's a 455 KC can. So any of those lugs would probably work if it's the right diameter. And, you know, when those things are frozen, sometimes if you don't massage them properly, they'll crack it, even with a good alignment tool. You just have to be careful. Let me do a drop, and I have one more if we have time.
Go for it.
Okay, have a young ham who lives in an apartment, and he just wanted to let us know what he developed to use as an antenna, and it was approved by his mother. Dick, what a bright guy. He used two curtain rods that are existing in the living room, and he hooks his transceiver up to the curtain rods, and one is about 10 foot long. The one on the right that he shows me here is around 7.5 feet long. These are big, large brass Kirsch rods, and he gets excellent results with them. I just thought you'd enjoy that. That's clever. And it's inobtrusive. The wires go, the wire runs down behind the curtain, and the antenna rods is, the curtain rods are still up. So what do you think of that? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
John, did he mention what band he's using it on?
No, he didn't mention the frequency he was operating on, but I know he's running two different frequencies. That would be interesting, but I'm not aware of What did you use?
A dipole on 10 meters is in the vicinity of 16 feet long. He's got 10 feet on one side, 7.5 feet on one side, around 17.5 feet, a little bit on the long side, which means if he's using it on 10 meters, when it's a little bit too long, it's going to be slightly inductive. But if he's got an antenna tuner, that's easy to compensate for it. With a wide enough brand tuning range of his antenna tuner matchbox, Eric wants me to call it a matchbox, it's quite possible he can use that curtain rod antenna on 20, 15, 17, and 10 meters, so to speak. It's going to be hard to use on 40 meters, but I think he can use it on quite a few bands. As long as he can bring it into resonance with his tuning controls, it'll work like a charm. And that's a very crafty hidden antenna. A stealthy antenna. Part of the curtain. The curtain itself is quite transparent. Assuming the wall is ordinary wooden 2x4s and sheetrock lathing and whatever, rather minor perturbation to the antenna. Again, adding a little bit of capacitance to the ends. Again, tuning it a little bit low. He's a little bit long in length. He's a little bit low in frequency. But with his matchbox, I think he can make that fly. Did he say whether or not he's using a matchbox, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Yes, he is using a transmatch, that's for sure, and good results. Also, this brings something else to mind. All of these young hams that only have a small terrace or maybe a little balcony, they could rig what looks like a curtain rod. Nobody would know that it's an antenna, and that's another stealthy thing to be using. Whether they put it on the front of the window or near the railing, they could even hang a plastic shower curtain on it if they want. Talk about stealth. There you go. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
If he has a balcony on the apartment, there's lots of ways you could use the railing of the balcony with slight modifications and convert that into an antenna. You'd be amazed how many ways you can do that. A guy who's got a tower in the backyard, and assuming he's willing to put in a couple of insulators with the guy wires match the tower, so that the guy wires are not acting as a top hat capacitor, and the bottom of the tower is being well grounded with grounding rods and or a bunch of ground plane radials. There's lots of ways you can feed power into this continuous metallic object called radio tower. You don't have to put an egg insulator in the center and feed it like a dipole. There's various ways you can feed it like a gamma match, a T match, half of a T match, half of a gamma match, and so on. Lots of ways you can couple RF energy into a metallic structure. So if you can do it with a tower, I know you can do it with the railing on the balcony of an apartment, and you don't even have to cut slots in the railing, so to speak. There's lots of ways you can launch power into it. So I think there's a couple of books on stealthy antennas. Any other, John, before we go over to the space report? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
No, that's about it, Dick. Quite a few quick ones tonight. Very easy. And something informative there. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, let's go over the space report and see what Paul has for us. KC2WGB. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, I did a quick look on the size of black holes, Paul, which you gave me a hint on it. And that is, if you double the mass of a black hole, opposite of common sense, its Schwarzschild radius or diameter also doubles. It's a linear relationship. Every time you double the mass of a black hole, you could say the diameter of the black hole, the part that you can just barely see, also doubles. And that supermassive black hole, a couple of weeks ago, they discovered that between 14 and 20 billion solar masses. That particular black hole, I believe, is considerably larger than our solar system. The diameter of that black hole is, I believe, considerably bigger than the orbit of Pluto. I mean, if you're standing back far enough, you can see the whole solar system that we live in. There's a little bit of a dot in the center from that point of view that we call sun. Can you imagine a sun-like device, very heavy black hole, that's bigger than the whole darn solar system beyond the orbit of Pluto? That's a mind blower. And if you come within a zillion light years of that thing, it's going to suck you in. Oh boy,
That's a place to avoid. That's a real death trap in many ways.